So yeah, so we are gonna. I'm gonna talk about the other kind of way of making explosions from, you know, real things where you take good old potential energy, not this dirty nuclear energy, and make clean, nice, clean explosions. Not that clean. But this is some work on what I really want to show, and what we'll get to in the end of the talk. So I'm gonna. Here's my little talk outline. And I'm going to start with the end, telling you is how we are starting to calculate light curves. And the reason I thought this audience would be a good audience to see this is maybe you guys can either tell us we're idiots, or also see if there's other applications for the techniques that we're developing. But we're going to start off with a little bit on collapsars, which is surprisingly the favorite long-duration gamma ray burst progenitor. And I'm going to talk about some nucleosynthesis on that, and then the light curves. And we're focusing on some dim supernova, and how I thought this is actually work that started a year ago at the ITP on studying gamma ray bursts from black holes that form through fallback. And so I'll describe that here. This is a very old slide. We've already established that I'm old and look back. So this is an old slide, 1997, it's only 10 years old, of different ways of making gamma ray bursts. There are various merger scenarios, but the one that a lot of people focus on, and the one I want to focus on in this talk, is the collapsar model. These are all in the same class of models that I like to call the black hole accretion disk models, because then they were the bad GRB models, where you get a black hole and you have angular momentum, and that angular momentum in this, whatever object you have, makes the material falling in on the black hole hang up in a disk, and then you use some way of extracting that energy in the disk to drive your gamma ray burst. And the collapsar model is one where you have a massive star, it collapses down to a black hole, the massive star is rotating for one reason or another, likely because it's in a binary, and that after you form the black hole, you can actually form a disk around it. And the reason a black hole, I mean, for me at least, the reason the black hole is better than, say, a neutron star model of the same ilk, you know, some kind of collapse model, is exactly demonstrated by this plot right here, where I have enclosed mass of a star and a specific angular momentum in that mass zone of the star. And if you say, well, if I collapse down to, say, a 1.5 solar mass object, it's likely to be a neutron star, this is the kind of angular momentum that I'll have. And yes, you can form a disk-like structure with this, but it's not, you don't really form a nice accretion disk with such a structure. If I can wait and first form a black, let it accrete and become a four solar mass object, so likely a black hole, I suddenly am tapping an angular momentum reservoir that's five times higher. So I have more angular momentum. So one of the reasons why it's nice to wait until you formed a black hole is simply that most stellar models predict that you'll have a lot more angular momentum if you wait and get to the higher levels of material. So this is at least, you know, just one reason why collapsing down to a black hole adds some energy physics that I can attack more easily, and that is I have more angular momentum.
Whose models are those?
These are actually, I think this is a Hegger model.
Is there an agreement between Hegger's and Yoon's models? I mean, how do they differ, actually?
The problem is that Yoon's models don't go to collapse. So I don't have a just at collapse phase. And the angular momentum doesn't change that much, but the radius is enough different that it's hard to compare directly. They are close. I mean, Yoon's models, especially those rapidly rotating ones that they're working on, always have enough angular momentum. They're great. So, but it's easier to tell this one if you've modeled it, because a lot of these features are because of the shells. And so if you don't model beyond carbon burning, you don't have a lot of this structure yet. So that's, you know, just my reason why I'm going to stick with things that form black holes. And then the other little piece of evidence that I'm going to use for this talk is that there's two ways to make black holes. One is that the star collapses, it does not drive a supernova explosion, and it just keeps on accreting until the central remnant collapses down to a black hole. And that's called the direct collapse scenario. And we really don't know where that line is drawn, but at some point I drew a line around 40 solar masses, and I seem to still stick with it. This is something that hopefully we may end up having to wait for observations to tell the difference. But the issue here is that as you get more massive, it's harder to drive an explosion. So the more massive stars are more likely to be ones that collapse directly to a black hole. There's another scenario that you can have where, and these four dots are actually simulations that we did, and then we fit random curves to these four dots. But there's another scenario where you'll get a weak explosion, and most of the results these days are weak explosions, where you get an explosion that's 5 times 10 to the 50 ergs, so it's less than the typical 10 to the 51 Fow, one Fow explosion. And these stars will send out a shock, but that's not enough energy to unbind the star. And eventually you'll have material falling back in, and that material will eventually make it collapse, and you'll make a black hole. And our estimates from just these simulations was that around 20 solar masses, you should expect to have stars not have enough energy to eject enough of their envelope to remain a neutron star, and they'll become black holes. So this should be roughly the boundary where you make neutron stars and black holes. And it turns out that in this picture that is in part held together by wishful thinking, Ken Nomoto has kind of looked at different stars with his big team, the Japanese mafia or the Yakuza or whatever you want to call them. And they have results where you have all the normal supernova going off here. And when you get to about 20 solar masses, you have a bifurcation point where you either have weak supernova, which is like these weak explosions we're getting, or you get something that's a hypernova. So the kind of picture that's held together by dreams and wishes is that these weak supernova are exactly what we're getting from our simulations now, and these hypernova are, I formed a black hole and maybe I can, I have a new mechanism, and that's the gamma ray burst engine. So that's the picture we have for these, or these are the, you formed a gamma ray burst engine. But what happened for all of these objects is you started with a weak supernova, and then for a fraction of them, you got something exciting. And it really is a fraction because these guys they have less energy, they make less nickel. These guys are going to be much dimmer than these guys that produce a lot of nickel.
Is it angular momentum that determines which way you go with that branch?
So that's our belief.
Okay.
So then we got to this point where how many of these are fallback black holes versus direct collapse, and is there a way to differentiate them? So what we at some point decided to do is let's study the nucleosynthesis and figure this out. And so we ended up doing some things where we would take two different models. We had a 40 solar mass and a 23 solar mass model. We would explode them with a weak explosion and then look at the accretion rate onto that compact remnant. And here are some accretion rates onto these objects where you can see that it takes some time. This one takes actually nearly 4 or 5 seconds, and then it starts accreting like crazy and drives the remnant mass up above 2.5 solar masses. And at some point then you can imagine that you have this weak explosion, you have a lot of a fallback, and then it's during this fallback that I make my black hole. If there's angular momentum, I can make an accretion disk. And that's where you could say, okay, now that's I've now made my black hole. But the problem is, as far as making GRBs, is that the accretion rates in these fallback black holes are much lower than a direct collapse black hole. So the accretion rate's lower, so it may be harder if we actually knew what the engine was doing. You would think that lower accretion rate is going to be harder to make an explosion. And it's also, what I want to talk about here is that it also means that the yield, if it's a long delay, the yield from these kind of fallback black holes will be very different. And I'm going to try and explain how the yield will be different in the next couple slides. So there's two ways to make the yield. One is if I can make heavy elements through the accretion disk itself and have a wind blowing off. And that's what Rebecca Surman and Gail McLaughlin and Rafe Hicks and collaborators have been doing. And also Jason Pruitt and Sam Woosley. And the issue I have with that, they can calculate nice yields where they, depending on parameters they use for the wind off of this disk, they get different values. But the fears I have right now is that they're assuming that the neutrinos are driving the wind in these disks, kind of like our process winds in a neutron star. And the problem is that most of these accretion disks, the winds are driven by viscous heating. And I'm not quite sure we've nailed down exactly what you can get from these yields. And certainly in these models, they can get a whole range of yields depending on how they play with different parameters. So, you know, certain parameters, they make a lot of this is scandium 45, for an example, but then in other parameters, they don't make any. So I mean, it's pretty much they can get a range of answers. And until we understand how accretion disks behave, we're stuck with just a parameterized result. The other way to make the nucleosynthesis is if you're blowing up a star, in normal supernova, the nucleosynthesis comes from explosive nucleosynthesis. Your shock goes through and it burns your silicon layer into heavy elements. It burns your oxygen layer, some of it, into silicon. And you can that's how you do the nucleosynthesis. And this is kind of what, if you look at a lot of the Nomoto and Maeda papers, that's kind of where they're getting their nucleosynthetic yield. So those are the two processes. And we focused on this one. So. And we wanted to see how the fallback black holes would be different.
Question: What if wind and something gets an extreme phenomenon rather than just a hydro phenomenon? We're talking about the nucleosynthetic field, and there's no MHD in there.
Yeah, that's right. So I was saying it's going to be then the viscous dissipation of the magnetic. So that's my thing is they use neutrino winds. And it's really this viscous dissipation of an MHD disk that should determine how your wind is. And I mean, you'll see here that in our calculations, things like the temperature and the electron fraction and all of these factors are the ultimate yield is very sensitive to these.
Yeah, I'm
so
used to thinking of MHD turbulence as being the dissipation, so I don't think that it's viscous.
Those of us doing hydro, that's, you know, it's just a viscous term, you know, that's what alpha is, right? So I want to just show you some of the, I just want to give you guys the kind of the overview of what's going on in these, you know, how the physics is going to change. So I have this, it's a 5-panel slide of, we've taken a star, we're exploding it, and now I'm exploding it in 5 different ways. In this panel, this is one zone of a star, and I'm watching its temperature trajectory with time. I just did a very strong explosion, 10 to the 52 erg of a star, and asked, what does the temperature, how does the temperature evolve? Well, it stays pretty steady, then the shock hits it, it jumps up to a peak value, and it comes down. So that's its shock value, and this is just another zone further out. So these are two trajectories. Here is a weak explosion, and this is what happens in a weak explosion. It's less energetic. It's going to shock the material less. It's going to have a lower temperature. So here's if I just have a weak explosion. So those are the fates. What happens if I have a weak explosion followed by a strong explosion? What happens is the weak explosion sends material out. Then, at a later time, the strong shock catches up with it. But now the material is further out. It actually ends up not getting that second heating. It's not going to gain as much energy. And so here's an example. Here's a weak explosion, and then a long delay, and then the strong explosion hits it. And what happens? The strong explosion actually does not increase the temperature any more than the initial weak explosion. And this is a result of, it depends on the delay. So here's a short delay, and you get, here's the weak explosion, here's the strong explosion, and it's lower, but it's not, you know, it's not as low. And so you can see there's a general trend. The strong explosion energy and the peak temperature you get from the strong explosion decreases as I get a longer delay. So that's one effect that's going to change the yields as we with these weak fallback explosions. If there's a long delay, you will not shock the material up to the same high temperatures.
But that's just because this one's occupying a larger volume of shock.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's obvious, but... Yeah.
Right, usually that peak temperature is just 1/3 AT to the 4th times the available volume.
Yeah.
But like in the densities, I mean, the jump condition, you can pre-expand something, and then when it's coming down, hit it again, you won't look inside the density because the density is going to pre-expand.
And the other way that the long delay affects the other major way that we at least determined when we were doing this project was that the longer the delay, the more fallback you have. So you're just ejecting less of the inner material, so that makes a difference as well. So these are two of the what we determined to be the major differences in the yields. And let's just look at some of these yields where I have the black line is nickel, the dotted line is titanium, and the dashed line is the stable calcium in the end. This is iron 56 in the end, but it was nickel 56.
Sorry, because you ran away, I already lost the topic. So what is the source origin of the second explosion?
So it's a fallback. So I had a weak explosion, fallback making a black hole, then I had the GRB outburst.
From the fallback.
Yeah, the fallback creates my black hole, and then I have an accretion disk in the fallback.
So it's a composite kind of scenario.
Yeah, it's a composite kind of scenario. So you can see how it will affect the yields. Here's nickel in this scenario. If I have a delay, I produce less nickel. It's more centrally concentrated. You also get less titanium in that result. This plot was actually spurred on by Jim. It's Jim's fault that I made this plot. And one thing was to look, where's the titanium made relative to the nickel? And if you ask where's the mean position of the titanium and versus the calcium versus the nickel, the general trend we're getting is the nickel is actually made closer in than the titanium and then the calcium. And that's actually opposite what the general belief in the literature is. The titanium is always made in the very center. And so there's papers saying it's a good tracer of the where you make the mass cut. And it's not, it's not as simple as that. If you take away anything from this talk, it's that nucleosynthesis is not as simple as your parents or grandparents taught you.
They didn't think about the explosions,
Yeah, this is spherical. This is just 1D, simple 1D calculation. And then this is just the comparable for 40 solar mass model. We're actually because we get confused easily on nucleosynthesis, we decided it's time to try and understand yields. And we thought, and Amy can help on this when I start getting way off base, we thought that doing what I call the Brad Meyer approach, which Lee Santana did a very nice paper on, was one way to actually get us some intuition for what are yields. And the approach here is to do a grid of temperature versus density, and just say I have a peak rho. These are the density, peak temperature, peak density of a shocked material, and then just let it cool adiabatically and ask the question, what is its yield rate? And we then make these. They design these nice color plots where this is the yield of titanium 44 by mass fraction, where the yellow is 10 to the minus 2, and if you go to white, you're making less than 10 to the minus 10. And these dots here are different trajectories for different explosions. And for our weak, strong cases, you're looking at the blue dots and the light blue dots. So these are two different weak explosions with a strong explosion. And we thought what Lisa and Ted did a nice study is what's the dependence on the rates. We actually also wanted to ask the question, what's the dependence on the electron fraction? And that was even greater than anything else. These are the same plots. All these three plots are the same grid, same cooling off, but just changing the YE from 0.498 to 0.5 to 0.502. And at least with the with Frank Timmons' network, the 0.502, you suddenly stop making titanium in a huge range, which happens to be where a lot of this our inner material is. So this is why the titanium is not necessarily in the center, especially if you have a YE that can shoot up above 0.5.
From the where helium's ideal, then you just don't have
not entropy dependence of that operation that's important, but actually having an opposite amount of opposite.
But how this kind of approach has helped us is that we can then take our models where we've done an explosion and try to understand what's physically happening. And I'll show good news first, or optimistic news first. These dots here are the titanium yield from a post-process calculation where we had trajectories. We actually, on each of those trajectories, we calculated with time what their yield was. And then we did something where we just took these TP grow peaks and let the adiabatic cooling get the result. And this solid line is if you didn't have weak electron capture rates turned on. And you can see the solid line in this region just does not match these results at all. So then we turned on the weak electron capture rates, which would lower the YE, and that's this dashed line, and it actually explains this feature. So we learned one thing, at least in the center, you really have to worry about your capture rates and your electron fraction in quite some detail. And the capture rates happen are more important in the center where it gets hotter, and it does make a difference. So we're hoping that by... I think the past methodology on how you do this is you calculate some trajectories, you post-process, get a yield, and you say, here's my yield. And you go and do another one. But I think we're at the time where we need to actually sit down and say, really, what physics is important in doing this? Just let's not just run the network, the huge network we have, and get an answer. But let's actually learn the physics of what are the important pieces that we should really be studying. Now, the bad news is you see that none of the plots match all that well in the titanium here. Out here, it's not surprising that they don't match because these TP grow peak solutions we're doing really assume you're going into NSE and then coming out. And at this point, your initial abundance starts to play a big role. And that's actually true out in this model as well. These are two different explosion models. But you can see that even we have something that we don't understand in the inner region of this thing. We can't match it with our models at all. So there's a lot of things that don't match at all. So there's a lot of physics we still have to understand of what's physically going on. And I think we still have a long slog to actually understanding what physics do we really care about when we're doing nucleosynthesis. But these are the kinds of approaches we're trying to understand exactly what's changing the yields. What we're using right now is the tritude method of I have some trajectories, I do a post-process nucleosynthesis, and I go with those results. But I think there is a lot that we can be learning about the physics if we
start to pay attention. Is the post-processing, or you're not post-processing?
I think the post-processing is fine. We're just not knowing what parts of the physics in that network are really driving things. And certainly there are the effects, because we just assumed the adiabatic cooling with a certain time, you know, we said it's constant, essentially constant velocity, you know, it's expanding at some velocity and it's cooling. Because we're assuming that kind of cooling rate, that's going to change the yield. So we're always going to, we didn't expect one-to-one it's going to make the right answer just by looking at TP grow peak. But we are going to use those TP grow peaks to try to understand what physics is the crucial physics in the model. So we did all this. We said we should expect if fallback supernova actually can make, fallback black holes actually can make gamma ray bursts. And if the fallback delays are long, we expect some gamma ray bursts to have dim supernova. And there was some evidence, but nothing strong. And at the same time we submitted that paper in March, we had some nice bursts go off that had exactly this result where here's the light curve of those bursts, and this is what you would expect if you took something like a 1998 BW or an AP or an AJ, 06 AJ or 02 AP supernova. They should be showing up right here, and this is what they see in the observations, and several groups looked at this. And the only caveat I should say is that some of the groups say, oh, these are long-duration bursts with no supernova. The other solution is these are not long-duration bursts. So it's not clear that there's long-duration bursts with weak, dim supernova or no supernova associated with them. But, you know, I'm a theorist. I had a prediction for saying that I wasn't going to produce much nickel, and this is an observation that says they don't get it, so I'm going to say, let's see how well can we explain this particular burst with our fallback black holes. So can these be explained by fallback black holes? And can we use then these dim supernova to place limits on the nickel? So to go about doing that, yes, sir.
Don't go there. Don't go. The observers here were so uninformed, they did not follow the short GRB observations and understanding, and they ought to be ashamed of themselves. There is absolutely no question that this event is a short GRB.
So there's two bursts that you're talking about. And one of them, it's pretty sure it was a 1 second burst. It's probably a short burst. Well, the second one is longer.
There are three solid gold criteria that it matches for short bursts, and it doesn't match any criteria for long bursts.
But the second one, at least all groups agree that it was not a short burst, but one group argues that it's not a normal long burst.
The problem with that burst is that unfortunately it was not triggered burst in Swift from the bat. And therefore we do not have high signal to noise time history of the burst, and so it will never be able to be decided. But it looks exactly like all the short bursts with these long soft components.
Okay, that's a nice thing to say, but I'll tell the observers then the other approach I will take is we as theorists say you better have some that don't have supernova. So until you see those, you are not looking hard enough. So that's the other. That's
amazing amount of confidence, Chris.
And you know why I'll say I have an amazing amount?
You're perfectly right about that. It's just, it's appalling. You know, I described it with Ellen this talk. She had a very, even-handed view as you kind of do. But it's appalling that there has been all this confusion generated by something that is absolutely cut and dry.
Okay. Well, it's nice to hear both, your view on this. I will say this. The reason I can get this sure about, I can say, look, you should go look for these is 10 years ago I said you should have neutron stars that have masses above 1.4 solar masses. Every observer, every time I gave the talk, Alex Filipenko, everybody would say, we don't see them. I said, you better look harder. And, when they found them, I finally at least said, this is where theory, at some point, fallback black holes must happen.
But we always had this relay, so I'm left with a 5-star.
Yeah, apparently they would always throw it out whenever I would show these results. They always told me I was,
you're so crazy. So much spectrum that you could never get it done.
Yeah, I know. But, I can tell you, I had several observers, every time I gave a talk back in 2000, I was getting yelled at for giving it. So, I think fallback has to happen. This is a prediction of fallback. Two answers. If you never find one, it means that fallback black holes are not making GRBs. That's the kind of solution in the end. And that would be nice to know. So we decided we're going to calculate some light curves for these. We're using the code RAGE, which is a LANL-based code. It's called Radiation Adaptive Grid Eulerian. It's an adaptive mesh refinement scheme. The hydro solver is not really that sophisticated. It's fairly primitive. So it's not really as nice as the adaptive mesh refinement scheme with hydro solver that's in the Chicago Flash code. But what it does have that's nice is a multi-group flux-limited diffusion scheme. And we're going to show you some single energy, some gray simulations here. And it's connected to the LANL opacities and equations of state. So it has a lot of the physics that you'd need for supernova. And it's a scheme that has 1, 2, and 3 dimensions. In 1D, it can do spherical explosions, and that's what we're going to show here. And we took the explosions from our weak strong models. This is a density profile. We have a wind on top. The wind here was based on the progenitor model that we had, which was a 2 times 10 to the minus 5 solar masses per year. This is a mass loss rate that's 100 times lower to try to see how mass loss depends on, how the result depends on mass loss. And this is the density at later times when the shock is near 10 to the 14 centimeters. This is the velocity profile at these early times. They almost all look the same. At later times, this is a model with short delay. It has this nice, if I plotted this log-log, you'd see a nice homologous flow, or linear-linear, you'd have a nice homologous flow. Here's the plot of the longer delay. They haven't yet gotten to homologous flow, but they're getting pretty darn close.
So you're the foreman of your dense shock in this?
The reverse shock is pretty weak in these because it's a really strong explosion. It's 10 to the 52. Or just, so it's not a huge reverse shock, but this right here could be part of that feature. And here's the light curves that we got. And us being amateurs at this had some surprising results. The solid line is where, in this particular calculation, the gamma rays, the energy from the nickel decay was deposited directly wherever the nickel was, all of it. And so we ran a calculation, and it peaked up early, came down short, and then you can see a nickel-powered late time light curve. This is time in days. We then decided, well, let's see how much our result was dependent on the nickel that we were adding. So let's just assume that 99% of the nickel energy, decay energy, escapes. And it ended up getting a larger peak. And the reason was it made the shock sharper. And it turns out that this peak is all dominated by the thermal energy. So it's the thermal energy that's dominating the peak. And so it goes higher, but again, because it has less nickel at the end, it goes down faster. So you have something that drops faster in that simulation. And when we realized it was thermal energy that was driving the light curve, we realized that a model with a lower mass loss rate would have a lower peak. And indeed it does. It goes up not nearly as far, and it then drops like a rock. Well, when people look at gamma ray bursts for supernova associated with them, they look after the afterglow has died out, and they're looking after 10 days, they're looking over here. And in fact, this is where their observations are roughly at, this level. And so they actually would not see an object like this unless they saw this little peak jutting out in the afterglow itself. But the afterglow is still pretty strong at these 7-8 day.
What energy is that coming out in? What temperature?
Yeah, that would have been a good thing for us to calculate. Because we did a single energy, this is just the bolometric light.
And it's almost certainly all of the UV. It's in the higher.
If you just saw a bump at 4 days in 07, 03, 11, and we're wondering what it is.
So Chris, this is a 20,000 kilometers per second shock.
Yeah, is that right?
So the temperature that's relevant for that is about, it's roughly 30 to 40 kV.
Yeah, it's going to be.
Most of the energy goes out in that band, and then it's thermal black body kind of thing.
Yeah.
So much less goes into optical.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So this is not in the optical. So you're gonna, and the reason I don't have the, I have conclusions. It was trivial. We could have done a multi-group thing where we picked band passes that you guys might care about, and we just didn't. So I mean that's one thing. The feedback of if you had done this, this would have been useful. This is why we're giving this thought. So
do everything.
Yeah. Well, we don't really want to do 10,000 groups. I'm happy to do. If you could give me 50 groups, I'd be, or 10 groups, I'd be ecstatic. 50 groups, I'd deal with it. So, but that's where it's the way flux image diffusion works. Two groups is twice as slow as, so it takes two times longer than one group. So that's how it slows me down. The advantage of it is that the hydro takes about half the time. So 50 groups will take me about 25 times longer, but that's not impossible on my own machine. So my conclusions are the nucleus synthesis for fallback black holes will be different. There'll be less heavy element production in most cases, but the exact yields are sensitive to a lot of effects that we are still trying to track down. Fallback black hole GRBs can produce dim supernova. If the delay is not long, they won't. So the claim that I said is if you don't see any dim supernova, then there's no you don't see gamma ray bursts with just dim supernova. There's no fallback black holes. The real claim is there's no fallback black holes with long delays. But this would be, even that would be an interesting result. That would help us constrain. If you could say there's none, that would, we've seen this many and we have none. That really constrains what we're using for the collapsar model. And the last result is that, when you measure these supernova light curves, it's less telling you what the nickel yield is. And I think more for these energetic supernova where you're 10 to the 52 ergs,
it's more an indicator of the mass loss, and that's a thing that we can maybe be looking at instead of. So when someone tells me they got a nickel yield using the Arnett relation for some of these objects, I start to not trust the nickel yield they're giving me. And where we want to go for now, from now, is multigroup. It's in the code. It's just a switch. It's just me doing about 10 minutes extra work and then waiting a little longer. So why did we not do it at the beginning? It's because I didn't want to do it. We want to actually do the gamma ray directly, and we have a scheme now that is in the code now that will do the gamma ray transport in a discrete ordinate method, and it's we're going to start testing it next week. So then we will also have the gamma rays put in the right way and not say let's let some escape. We want to do post-process on top of this. So ideally, you would then take these results. You have a fairly good estimate for the temperature profile of the ejecta, and you can just, you know, do a more sophisticated scheme to actually post-process and get good spectra estimates. And then the last thing that this code is prepared to do is to, you could model things like this, where you have asymmetries in the explosions, and actually get light curves from that. So we're pretty much, this is the new technology that we've developed. We're hoping to do, I think there's, for you guys that do 1As, it's less important because the hydro, rad hydro effects are less critical. But if you have any models that you think you care about rad hydro effects in the explosion, we're doing the rad hydro in the explosion, so we're getting a nice result. So we're kind of geared up to start doing this, and hopefully, and we can argue for a lot of time at LANL to do computations for people. And please send me anything that you think would be a cool object to study, and I'll stop there.
Thank you. We have time for discussion. We have already some discussion, but it's I on both of the speakers.
Chris, are you expecting radically new things to come out when you jump to the multi-dimensions, or fine-tuning of what you've already found?
I think for these things, especially like the asymmetric supernova and core collapse, we're going to see different results. It's going to make a difference. Whether it'll... especially at the level we should be caring about as we get better and better data. So I think if you're just trying to match some ratty light curve, it doesn't matter. But if we're getting more and more detailed data, this should make a big difference. And certainly Peter Huflick in the past has argued it will make a big difference. And things like getting polarization are the other obvious effects we'll see in the asymmetry. Well, and then this the thing that you have to fold in is, do they make any explosion at all, or is fallback just not a high enough accretion rate to make a GRB? But yeah, if I just said they have the same, they make the same number of GRBs as the direct collapse, you should expect them to be a lot more frequent. I think the answer is only, you know, it's going to be at most 1% of these guys, and that tells us something about the engine. But I would like some firm, you know, I would like to say we can't do it.
We know that even just type 1C supernova, only one of 1,000 produces GRB, you know, point of any direction. And so it's already a very rare phenomenon within 1C supernova for reasons that stories can be told that don't really know. And so, setting aside the GRB connection, surveys that are ongoing, then you would, even if they didn't produce a GRB, the rate would be very, very high. And, you know, have you done estimates?
Oh, so if the rate is not, if they don't produce a GRB, the object that you end up getting from these fallback guys is this.
And Philip Podzielowski get a rate for these. These are probably 100 times more frequent than these, even though you see fewer of them.
Well, I mean,
so that's essentially, you know, if
but
they all just...
There's, you know, the surveys that are ongoing, the question was, you know, how sensitive are they? And since the rate is so high, you know, what limits can we place just for the fact that, you know, that there haven't been any seen?
Yeah, so the ones that don't make... Oh, yeah, so from the ones that are GRBs that you don't see anything. Is that...
No, ones that don't.
So from these numbers here, you get that these could be 100 times more frequent than these.
Right, but what did the observations say about that?
That's what the observations say. So that was Philip Podzielowski looking at the observations and asking, what do I get from the... And so it could be that that's all these fallback guys do. And then what you're... And if that's... If we can prove that, what that ends up telling us is, first of all, that's going to put... That tells us something about where should this line be drawn. It tells us also if the accretion rate is this value, it's not going to make a GRB. If the accretion rate is this value that's higher, it does. And that will help us in mechanisms once we actually start doing mechanism physics and not just waving our hands.
So, Chris, I must say you are in very strong competition regarding building toy models with type 1A modelers. Now, this is, I mean, we are beating still the field of type 2s, I believe, but so we are doing better in type 1As than you do here. But when it comes to modeling the second explosion, you are dealing with a non-rotating star or with very low angular momentum. So essentially you are talking about exploding object that's formed in the spherically symmetric collapse to the black hole. How do you want to explode that?
Oh, you mean because I was running in 1D and how was I imagining an exploding in 1D?
You know,
the scenario is this.
Rotating core.
Well, so the scenario we had was we're using a 1D star to model something, but that should have been this. So we're assuming what's making the explosion for the GRB.
Right, so I wonder what makes that central part, you know, the torus around the black hole, when you don't have rotation.
When you don't have rotation?
Well, you have the supernova, that means that you don't have, you are not on the path to the rotating. Right?
No, I assume that I am. I do have a rotating. I'm a dim supernova because I didn't make. The question is how much nickel did I make? I didn't make a lot of nickel. I didn't make 0.5 solar masses of nickel. So the reason it's not a bright supernova. If I make 0.6 solar masses of nickel, the nickel will dominate the light curve, and that will be a bright nickel-driven light curve. But I'm saying I made my disk. My disk didn't contribute to the nickel. I'm making it the way Ken Nomoto makes his nickel, which is explosive nucleosynthesis. And because I had a weak explosion and then a strong explosion, I didn't synthesize much nickel. My explosive nucleosynthesis didn't make nickel. So I have a dim supernova because I did not make 0.5 solar masses
right.
of nickel. I
there
made
you don't have protection, right?
No, because the rotation doesn't make the nickel. It's the explosive nucleosynthesis that makes
it. But you waited long enough that the accretion rate that's happening when the strong explosion would get launched is lower. So if you looked at how the mass of that remnant was growing, it grew very fast, but that was because the very fast growth, very fast accretion rate, was creating the black hole in the first place.
Okay.
And then moderate accretion rates later. So the GRB or the second explosion that you would drive
but for that
is
you need
lower.
To have
rotation. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm assuming
you have rotation, but it's just you're waiting longer, so you're getting to the point where the stuff was not accreting in as fast.
Maybe these. Let's see.
Yeah,
if I
so I think the diagram, Nomoto's diagram is good because. Okay.
Let me. These. All these models, except for this one, these four models all have the same explosion energy in the end. They all assume the 10 to the 52 erg
right.
explosion.
I just don't understand the part where you start forming the second explosion, you know, how you actually come up.
I'm assuming that there's rotation.
Okay.
In all these, the assumption is you have rotation, and then the question is just when did you form the black hole?
Very good.
So I don't know if I saw your light curve right, but it looked like it was very bright. That light curve calculation?
Yeah, it's because it was a 10 to the 52 erg explosion. So, and it's all in the, like Tomek said, it's all up in X-ray.
It's one of the brightest.
Yeah, it's
except that at the time when you might be able to see it coming out from behind the power law spectrum, it's
dropped.
Right, it's very fast.
Yeah.
It's very fast.
But if you weren't looking along the GRV direction, you should see a very bright short.
So, but only if you have a lot of nickel, you can still see it.
Yeah, that's right. Only and the issue with this one is the explosions are not 10 to the, you don't take a 10 to the 52 erg explosion in a 1D sense and do these. I mean, really, I have to do it in multi-D because it's the velocities I should have had is some asymmetric thing like what Ken Nemoto is to use.
You need like an order of magnitude variation of the light curve.
Yeah.
Those penguins were 2P, so they had a hydrogen envelope that probably slows the energy output out and makes them brighter. I mean, not as bright, but longer lasting. If you had it as a 1C, it really probably would only last 4 days and then it's gone.
Could we look at that light curve?
It's just a lot, just two lots, Chris. I don't know if it's in the mix.
Yeah, these they're bright, but they're bright mostly because I did this spherically symmetric 10 to the 52 erg explosion, and it's all thermal energy. So, you know, if I made it a 4 times 10 to the 51 erg explosion, all that's going to go down.
But if we, you know, like the tone is saying, this is going to show up in X-rays, and instead of XRT, probably can't see this.
It will be very hard X-rays.
Yeah,
100 KV.
It'll be 30 KV, 100 KV. If you scale down by U squared or something like that, for the part of the spectrum, then it would be down by factors of several thousand. In the molecule, so it might not be surprising.
Just one thing: this question of nickel versus titanium. Have to be careful. There's one object we know of, and that's Cassay, for which we have information on titanium 44. And we look at it and we say, if that were present in solar abundance with respect to nickel, we should have seen Cassay. We should have been observable, and it was not. The other issue is the entire halo of a galaxy, all of the halo field stars, all of the halo globular clusters, have a high titanium to iron ratio by a factor of 3. And that ratio is not 44. That comes from titanium 48, which comes from chromium 48. So whatever you do with your mass cut has not only to influence the 44 along the alpha chain, it has to influence the chromium along the alpha chain. And that may be more trouble for you.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think we have, matching the observations of yields is going to be hard. But one thing I would say is, well, what I hadn't realized is, okay, what's hard for me to do is make the higher titanium to nickel to iron ratios. This has always been a problem, and especially if you say, well, it's only made here, because then you have to get the iron out to get it. But in this case, if I cut off here, I actually started to get a higher titanium but you're going to have to tell me. I mean, the problem I have is right now I don't know what to do with our results because we're getting different things every time we run a calculation. And so we have to get to the level that we're saying, this is the physics that we really need that will make our titanium well, and what conditions do we need to make these things? But it's not so straightforward as the titanium will always be in the center and, you know.
You get the progenitor star that you're going to be doing all of your five stuff that already has YEs that are seem too low for what you think should have gotten there. And then you run your core plots and you reset the YEs either lower or higher, you know, all over the place. And the YEs make a big difference with the stuff. And so it's a lot of what people have done in the past when they're doing these is they'll take their progenitor and they'll reset the YE of the progenitor before they can begin to blow it up. So, I mean, there's a lot of ad hoc things being done with the light compression before these nucleosynthetic calculations are being done. And they're guided by what you think ought to be there, but, I mean, you know, I don't really know. There's certainly a lot of controversy about what the neutrino fluxes from the neutron star are going to do.
But I would say the way I would see making progress in this particular field is, this is where I like the kind of Meyer approach, which is we have to learn we can't just keep on doing lots of simulations and give you a set of, here's this star produced this yield. We need to actually know what physics drive, because you know, if I start resetting my Y and over reset it, which a lot of models are doing now, well then I just killed a lot of my titanium.
Even just the uncertainties in the rates, and that even gives you some variation. But there's a lot of uncertainty in that in the explosion mechanism of the fourth glass. That it turns out most of this mining is done by 3 seconds, and that's the time scale for launching the explosion. So all the physics of launching an explosion is setting the trajectory profile at every fluid element goes through, setting what the nuclear synthesis. You really have to understand the sensitivity with respect to the physics of the mining.
But this CASA, even CASA, is causing us a lot of problems. We cannot get above solar titanium to nickel ratio, and you know, we have a measurement. So
our favorite model for CASA was the one where we showed we're using this kind of thing. Basically, the entire spectrum, the entire range of enclosed mass, we didn't quite understand what's going on.
You don't think CASA was a gamma ray?
I think it was. Well, I do think it was on this boundary. I think it's near, you know, I think it was a progenitor that was near 20 solar masses. It's somewhere straddling. And so it's going to be a weird object. So that may be the saving grace, is I can say, well, it's a weird object, and we'll find it. But so, yeah, I mean, you guys have a, well, I don't know, I shouldn't say you guys, but the Japanese group has several papers on, I think, objects that may be very similar to what CASA was, and it wasn't your, you know, well-behaved. It was one of those guys you send to the corner with the little hat.
This is a very interesting discussion, but I think
we better stop.
Cut it off. Let's say.